Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Adrienne Nicole LeBlanc, who has a nonfiction book, Random Family, subtitled Love, Drugs, Trouble, and Coming of Age in the Bronx. You know, over the course of the quarter century that I've been doing this program, Random Family sits alone. I've never read a book quite like this. What it is it's, 12 years. In the lives of four young, I think they're all Puerto Ricans?
Yes.
All four of them. Four Puerto Ricans in the South Bronx, their family, their extended family, their friends, their children. It's unusual in that there is very little in the way of author commentary. The author sits on the side in this book so that you just follow these people and you learn rather than being told what is going on and you make your own judgments. When you were working on the book, was that part of the initial conception or the conception as it grew that you would kind of keep yourself out of the book as much as possible?
In the journalism I've done writing, especially about young people, well, perhaps I should say as a reader, I am often frustrated when the journalist emerges in the narrative, especially as a character. I get a little bit suspicious because I think, oh, there must have been some kind of glitch with the reporting. Or my expectation is that they better be incredibly interesting to take my time away from the information that I feel hungrier for. So I never like to be in the story overtly, and at the same time I'd say I think I'm all over the story in some other way by what calls my attention. But the thing I did try to do was write a story from, I don't want to say from the perspective of the people in the book, but a story where the things in their lives took on the proportion that they felt they merited rather than one from the outside might feel would be significant.
There's a total non-judgmental aspect to this that you get from the beginning. I think the first time we see someone take drugs, which I believe is Jessica's mother, Lourdes.
Yes.
It's absolutely non-judgmental, even when we discuss murder. How easy was it to keep that dispassion in your writing?
The way I'm wired, I guess, as a person, judgment isn't the, it's not one of the top 10 sort of responses I would have to something, but I also, when I'm reporting, I have a different head on than my sort of critical thinking head. So in a way, when I'm sort of just trying to absorb information, I feel very connected to just a sort of surrender to gathering it, and that I'm those parts of my brain that might try to assess what I'm hearing are not really alive until the writing. But I can't say I'm just it's not that I'm not a person who has judgment. It's just not, I don't find it very useful or particularly interesting generally. And for me, it's often a signal that I'm in the way of something, that there's something that's personally provoked by what someone's doing. So that my best journalistic self, which is not all the time, obviously, but is to just pay attention to that and get myself out of the way of it.
You began by working on an article, variously it says in one place Rolling Stone and another place The Village Voice.
Well, when I was a young journalist, when I moved to New York City, I was a freelance writer and had written a couple of small things for The Village Voice. But for the book, I had an assignment from Rolling Stone to do a profile of this young drug dealer who's a character in the book named Boy George.
Is that his real name?
Yes. His real nickname, his street name. That piece was killed by Rolling Stone and ended up published in The Village Voice, but it was killed in part because I became very interested in George personally, but the limitations of reporting on his life after the trial, his trial was over, it didn't sort of work with the kind of profile they wanted in my arrangement with him for the access he had given me.
So you began just talking to him.
Yes, for a straightforward profile. I was very interested. I was covering some court, doing some court reporting. I was stunned, absolutely stunned by the sentences that people were getting under the federal sentencing guidelines, obviously in drug cases, certainly in the state level with the Rockefeller laws. I just couldn't absorb what was actually happening to the teenagers I was watching. And George was very young when he was brought in on a RICO charge. So I was initially trying to understand the impact of those drug sentencing laws, but was personally interested in what it meant to be a young male in a single-parent family bringing in money from the drug trade. What did that actually do to a mother-son relationship? That soon gave way to many other interests in terms of family.
Well, what happened, it sounds like, is that you became friendly with Jessica,
One of his main girlfriends, yes.
And you, at that point, met Jessica's, Jessica, real name?
No.
Okay.
It's a pseudonym.
Okay. Let me ask this. One of the, before I go further,
sure.
One of the articles that I received here, there's a picture of the person you call Coco, described as Coco. Another place described that name is Lolly.
Well, she had, Lolly was a street name that she used in the decision for the news publications. The process of that decision about identifying was different. The book issue was in part for protecting giving the children some measure of privacy.
And Tony is Caesar?
Yes.
Okay, is that his real name?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, Tony, he had a number of street names, but he's since decided to come forward in terms of his, you know, actual name.
So anyway, Jessica's mother, Lourdes, and she has a brother, Caesar. Now, Caesar's later, one of his girlfriends, Coco, Jessica, and Boy George are more or less the primary characters,
yes.
Though there are many, many, many others, including Lourdes, her sometime boyfriend, husband, Robert, and this interrelated group of people. Now, the first 70 pages of the book take place before you ever met Boy George. So all that is based on interviews.
It's based on interviews. It's based on transcripts from a three-month trial in his case. Jessica had some legal involvement. The other thing that I was incredibly lucky to have access to were the wiretaps. The government had tapped the phone lines, and I was able to get access to those tapes, and it documented well over a month of phone calls. So I had access to actual dialogue, you know, documented dialogue as well.
So you would go back to Jessica and say something like, well, you said such and such on such and such a day. Can you talk about your feelings?
A lot of times, yeah, I would do that. I would, when I met her, she hadn't been arrested yet, and we spent time, you know, doing things together. So there were actually things that I did do with her. We would revisit places that she had hung out at. So, for example, there were certain moments in her relationship with Boy George that were quite significant to her, so we would try to go back to the place, and sort of, if it was a restaurant they'd eaten at, we would go, and I would say, did it look this way when you were here? Luckily, a lot of the sort of high events were people took pictures. There were lots and lots of photographs, and Coco was especially a shutterbug, and in her case, it was a lot easier because she took lots and lots of pictures, and she also had this unbelievable correspondence with Caesar when he was in juvenile detention on, so there was a lot of written documentation of their actual conversations.
You mentioned wiretaps. How did you get permission to listen to them?
I got permission through one of the attorneys, and through the people that were on the wiretaps gave me permission to listen to them.
Now, when you began this, you were going to be writing, and you did write about Boy George, but you decided that this other extended family was a more interesting subject, right?
Well, I think yes, because I initially had a contract to write a book about his drug business. I was never particularly interested in the business part of it, and I wasn't interested in the moral dimension of drug dealing as a question at all. It made perfect sense to me that people were dealing drugs in a community where there weren't other options of decent income. And the drug trade rarely gave them decent income anyway. But I immediately became interested in the women because I felt that it was a way into writing about the ordinary life of poverty in a very complex way, but in a much more true way than the moments one finds at a drug trial or talking about the drug business, because I almost immediately learned that it was a piece of a larger, richer sort of life, and I wanted to write about the life sort of in a broader sense, so drug dealing had to sort of take its limited role in the narrative in that way.
I have a quote from you. I was struck by the fact that you could write about men and not write much about women, but there was no way to write about women without writing about men.
I think that's really true. I mean, there was a way in which I could spend time with Boy George or some of the young men that had not been apprehended who are out in the world and craft a story that was very male-centered around the drug business and around the way in which they described their lives and the way that they spent their time, or that the role of women was sort of compartmentalized quite cleanly, that I did not find to be the case at all with the women. But the other thing that was a challenge about writing about the women, especially with Coco, because she was a very I would say, sort of ordinary person in the sense of a familiar person and not had not lived an extraordinary life, was that so much of what happened to her was psychological in a way. I mean, her days were sort of quite repetitive, and it was an interesting challenge to sort of capture the life of a young girl who was not, like Jessica, living at sort of, you know, a wildly fabulous life at one moment, a horrible life at the next, but it was a young girl just growing up in the ghetto, going on about her business.
Well, here's Adrienne Nicole LeBlanc, master's in philosophy and modern literature at Oxford, former fiction editor at 17 Magazine, walking into this Puerto Rican family. You speak Spanish, I take it.
I don't.
You don't?
No,
did they,
I don't.
Did they all speak
no,
Spanish?
No, Coco doesn't. I mean, the young people, the generation I was writing about, don't speak Spanish. Jessica's mom speaks Spanish with her mother. The great-grandmothers and the grandmothers spoke Spanish and communicated with their family in that way, but Jessica really learned a lot of her Spanish, as did Caesar, in prison, is when they sort of became much more interested in the language and certainly in their own sort of heritage.
Well, when you go in there and you say, and here you are, this educated white woman, what is the response? Did everybody just say, hey, great, write about us? Did you get any flack? Did anybody say, don't talk about
well,
me?
Well, there's certainly, I found reporting on, as a group, the young men much more suspicious than the women, because they suspected that I was they wondered if I was an undercover cop, so I was, you know, occasionally frisked to see if I was wearing a body mic or something. The women I found more receptive, really. I was very straightforward in what I was doing, and I wasn't initially clear. I would just say, I want to write a book about what it means to be poor, what it means to be growing up poor and being a girl, and what your life is like, what your regular life is like. And I think people find it maybe curious. I did have some people say to me, doubted that I could have been a legitimate journalist, because somebody with legitimacy, what would they be doing here? Like, if you're some kind of successful writer, why would you come to this neighborhood? Which was a devastating comment on, you know, a situation, really. But I think the main thing was people wondering what was taking me so long, because I wasn't producing, you know. So I would bring my clips to them to show them, but I found, like, handling the story that was available to me pretty much from the get-go, the challenge, more than sustaining access. It took me longer to get strong enough to field the story that was available than it did to begin to get access to that story.
Were you familiar with much poverty writing before then? Had you read
any books on
poverty?
I read a lot of books on poverty, and I grew up in a working-class factory town and had done a fair amount of reporting about kids, you know, runaways or kids connected to the street world in some way when I first moved to New York. So, and certainly anything that you write about criminal justice, I think, is fundamentally a story about poverty for the most part.
Well, when you're there, and you were finally there, and here were these people who were trying to hang on, and their lives are frequently out of control. Here you are, you're educated. Were they coming to you for advice? How did they view you?
You know, it was such a long experience. I don't want to generalize too broadly, but for the most part, there wasn't a terrific amount of curiosity about me. And I think almost immediately, the utility of my advice was next to nothing. Do you know, it wasn't like I was in a position to tell them anything they didn't know themselves. I mean, they had tried mightily to resolve situations that they knew far better than I did. I was really in the sort of posture of a student. There were occasionally young people who were already tracking themselves for other types of lives, who understood that I was a useful source of information. So, for example, there was one young woman who's the girlfriend of a kid who was applying to colleges and knew and asked me about colleges and asked me if I would read her essay, that kind of thing. But I really don't think I knew much that was of use.
And you couldn't help them with money because you were struggling
right.
yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. I did occasionally, after I got the lay of the land down and the lengthy waits in the welfare office or the health clinic, you know, might step up to the reception desk and see if we could cut the 4-hour wait down to 2 hours. But I have to say, though, the place that I found it the most difficult, and a few times did get involved and then was not able to use any of the material as a result, was, you know, once I went with somebody's little brother to an appointment with a parole officer, and the man was telling the young man something that was utterly untrue and said, you know, just tell me about this and it'll never come back to haunt you, whatever, and I just simply could not sit by at that moment. But again, I would then not be able to use what had happened in terms of the text.
Because it had to come out. If you were involved, it wasn't going to be there. Yeah. So you began learning about the family. You spent a while talking about them. It sounds from reading this that I'm not sure when Coco put an appearance. Was that after the trial?
Yes.
Yeah.
I had met her actually on several occasions, not fully understanding her role in the family in 89. And she was around when I first started the scene, but she and I developed a sort of direct sense of understanding who she was after Jessica's arrest. I had asked Jessica how I needed to reconstruct parts of her childhood and asked if someone might be able to help me as a guide around the neighborhood, and that's how she introduced me to Coco, who I then realized, I met you at the sentencing, and that's how it started.
As the book progresses, Coco becomes the central character of the book. Part of that, I guess, is because the other three are in jail.
Partly, but also because she's an incredibly honest person, and I think deeply desiring of expressing an inner truth that doesn't always get to play in her day-to-day life. And for a journalist, I think you can sort of have nothing better than someone who really, whether it was positive or negative, she had no sort of inhibitions about me seeing who she was. And that was an incredible gift. And she was a really inspiring person just to be around because, you know, strengths, weaknesses, good times, bad times, it was just the sort of force of her liveliness that I found absolutely remarkable and completely enthralling, really.
And then when you met her, she was only like 14, 15, 16. She was
young. She was pregnant with her third child. Yeah, and she was in a homeless shelter when we met.
And you're still good friends with her?
I am. I speak to her very frequently. And I really miss spending, that kind of time with her. That's the other part of it that what I love about writing about young people is I think the way their lives are sort of structured, they have more time to just hang around. I mean, it's not always a sort of purposeful reason why you get together, and I really cherish the years that I had with her.
How many children does she have now?
Now she has five. She was pregnant with the third when I met her, but she has five children now.
And how does she deal with it? Is she with the fifth
child's
father?
Yes, she's with the father of her fifth child who's been really involved in the raising of her family. It's certainly hard. I mean, she works a very low-paying, long-hour job.
One thing I've noticed through reading this book is jealousy is not really that strong here. Among the men, it was kind of, if you specifically say stay away, that's when they stay away. Otherwise, why not? Anybody sleeps with anybody. Nobody really seems to care that much. There's some jealousy between the women.
The women. I was going to say, the women certainly compete.
But the other part is the women have no problems raising children who aren't their own.
Yeah, I think the thing that I find fascinating is that I think the level of just sort of basic generosity, and I say this without, I don't want to sentimentalize it, but there really is a sense of generosity that is quite profound. I mean, truly extensive in a neighborly sense, watching someone's kids. Life isn't so heavily managed as I find sort of among middle and upper class people in a way where everything is sort of thought through. There's sort of a way like kids come along for the ride of life, which I found incredibly liberating just to sort of see that. But I think there's also an assumption of, I would often say to Coco, how do you do it? What do you do? And she would say, what's my choice? You know, there's an incredible pragmatism too, I think, to poverty, and the idea of sort of thinking about it or what your ideas are is really a kind of naivete that took me a long time to shake.
You're listening to an interview with Adrienne Nicole LeBlanc, whose extraordinary book is Random Family. Coco, now that the book has come out and she's getting some publicity, I mean, I see pictures here. She's in magazines. Has her life changed?
No, I don't think in a lasting sense. You know, my sort of secret hope, not the reason why I wrote the book, my secret hope is that there'd be some perceptive individual in power of some kind that could see that she's a person whose life holds much potential. So she would get, I would hope she'd get a great job or something from some of this. But I don't know. I think there's been some change in the recognition of her life as significant. Because one of the things that happened all the time when I was writing the story about her is nobody understood why her. Even her friends would say, what about her? She's just a regular girl. You know, people that have much worse lives, much harder lives, much more tragic lives. Why would you write about her? And I think she has always known that there is a value to what we were doing. I do think, at her job, people have been reading the book. she called me the other day from her work site and said, you know, they were all wondering if there was going to be a sequel because they felt she was still struggling and that that should be documented. Maybe in this sense there's been a change that in the neighborhood, I've been so excited to sense from some people this feeling that, like, you've told our story.
Adrian, you lived with these people. You got a small advance from Houghton Mifflin, mm-hmm. which ran out, and then
right.
you were scrambling to make money to find grants to keep doing this.
Right.
And they just went along with this. They said, okay, she's a writer. She'll eventually get a book.
Well, I think some of them, you know, really doubted that I would ever finish the book. I mean, I think they had serious doubts. There were long stretches of time that Boy George, for other reasons as well, but would get incredibly frustrated and angry and just not talk to me because, I mean, I wasn't seeming to produce. What was I doing? I had other assignments. I had just, you know, pieced my life together. Everyone had a different feeling. I know Caesar and I became incredibly engaged in the process in a way that was not true for the first 4 years. He became extremely interested. We had a very lively intellectual connection that continues to this day. I think Jessica sort of reached, you know, she was happy it was over when it was finally over. The final sort of fact-checking thing, she was very glad that it was over. Coco hopes that it would continue. They were all sort of had very different feelings about it.
Well, before we go into some of your conclusions, which are not in the book,
right.
but I want to ask
mm-hmm.
you about them, I'm going to ask you about where these people are today. Lourdes?
She's eagerly hoping for the release of Caesar, who's coming up for parole very shortly. She's living with a man who she met during the latter part of the book in a better living situation than she's had in a long time, and dealing with as many women her age that have grown up in the inner city has a host of very serious health problems that are really sapping her ability to be mobile.
She's about 50 now.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Coco has the five children.
She's five children.
Still living in the South Bronx?
No, she's living in outside of the Albany area in upstate New York, working long hours as an industrial cleaning person. They go to places where houses are burned down or crime scenes and do heavy cleaning.
And Caesar's still in prison.
Caesar's still in prison, coming up for parole. And Jessica has been working, you know, for years at a job that she has had several jobs, but she's working at a job she had gotten when she was released from federal prison.
And she's living in the Bronx still?
She's living in the Bronx, and her eldest child is reunited with her and since had a baby. So she's a grandmother and very involved in care of her grandson.
She's about 30, early 30s then.
Mm-hmm, she yeah. is. And Boy George is, you know, serving a life term with no option for parole.
And some of the other women.
Foxy, Coco's mom, again, is struggling really with a lot of health problems. I mean, the sort of accumulation of all kinds of stressors seem to catch up with the women in their late 30s and 40s in a way that is very serious. She's living with a boyfriend she had at the time in a neighborhood. She's moved out of the block where I did most of the reporting.
One final question before
sure.
we go into some of the conclusions. There's a murder in the book. A kid named Mighty is killed by Caesar. Were you there for that? Were you around that time?
I was around, but not focusing on Caesar at the time. I was on the scene, but not smart enough to know that it was something that I should be paying close attention to.
Did you know Mighty?
I didn't.
You never met him?
I can't say I never met him. I didn't know him. Yeah, we crossed paths, but I did not know him.
Adrian, now you're out of this, and you can look at it. I mean, you're still friends with these people, but you can look at it from a different perspective. What kind of lessons, in a broad sense, and then I can kind of narrow it in, do we get about poverty, about racism in this country, and what can we do about it? I know it's an incredibly broad question, but you know, you were on the inside and you've written a book. Where do we go from here?
Well, I think the one thing that I think, you know, anyone with an open heart and an active brain knows is that destructive environments do damage. You know, damaging circumstances damage people, and people, it takes a toll over time. I think the thing that I learned was that it wasn't so much the overt crises that we focus on, such as, you know, arrest or homelessness, the moment of homelessness, but the sort of accrual of a sort of series of chronic crises, like that the level of crises is, you know, it's more like a chronic illness. There are periods where it goes into remission, there are periods where it's acute, but that poverty is really a condition, that it's a complex toll in the cumulative sense that is worth paying attention to. But I came away feeling a real clarity about the simple things that need to be done, that have worked in the past when they've been supported and have been basically taken away from most of these communities. I mean, the prison spending should be returned to public education and youth programming. Youth programming is practically non-existent in a lot of urban environments for the most part on any wide level. I think it's in many ways a book about substandard housing. All the apartments are overcrowded and a host of problems evolve from that. I think public health issues around nutrition and basic medical care and certainly the mental health questions here are extremely serious. And I think I only came to understand the importance of the mental health issues once I finished the book and returned to a different balance in my own life and understood the degree to which I had also been affected, even only as a witness, by the relentless sort of stressors of the environment.
It's most obvious in Random Family in talking about Lourdes, who at one point has this enormous brood and very little money, and she's a good cook, but she can't find the food to put on the table.
That's right. And those, you know, the thing, that I guess that's another thing you're reminding me of, is that there is or there isn't. There's sort of never a steady amount of security. There, either you have food or you don't have food. So it's always this sort of frenetic, you know, up and down, up and down. And I think that also creates a kind of tolerance for chaos that I think a lot of trouble comes from in terms of trying, that when then young people are sort of put into structured environments like school where their ability to tolerate that kind of steadiness is complicated.
Would sex education make a difference
It would make an enormous difference. I mean, there's been a lot of, I've been invited to speak at a lot of Planned Parenthoods and people saying, what do we do? And I say, what do you think you do? The decision to keep a baby at 14, once pregnant, is a decision that had 100 opportunities prior to that moment that have to do with not just sex education, but the real availability of, you know, condoms and just viable, easy contraception.
In terms of Coco, by child number two, and you were around there, I mean, if she had questions about sex education and how to have a baby, she could have talked to you.
To her and to many of the young women in this particular community, sex was a question that collapsed. I mean, the question was sort of collapsed by that point. Once she was pregnant, the decision was whether or not to keep the baby. The choice to have sex, a lot of these girls, sort of, it all was mixed together. So sometimes when I would say, you know, you can be sexually active and not have to head in this direction, that's where contraception comes in. To them, once one made the decision to have sex, the rest was sort of part of the deal. And then, but at the same time, there were plenty of girls that tried to get abortions, couldn't get the money together, or their parents wouldn't allow them to. This was an interesting sort of residual effect of incarceration that I found anecdotally, which was so many moms and grandmothers were being sent to prison under the drug laws. The result of that was that when they were getting out, because their terms weren't quite as long as the men, was that they would return to families that obviously had been destroyed by their absence and some kids thrown into the system. And they had this enormous desire to make up for that. And one of the ways in which they would do that was they would want a grandchild they could start anew, that they could, you know, sort of make up for the errors that they perceived largely in terms of mothering. And that, I thought, was a devastating consequence of really prison policy in a strange way.
And drugs, there's nothing to be done about that, again?
Well, again, you know, the kinds of drug treatment that are available to the poor tend to come as a result of criminal arrest, and the quality of that treatment is, I think, questionable, the types of programs that are available. And for the most part, they're not available. But the one other interesting thing is, if you notice, none of the kids in this book are drug users, short of,
right,
you know, the occasional blunt that they smoke or whatever. But that the drug use for the moms really took off in their 30s, and I think there's a connection between the diminishment of a woman's sexual power and leverage in the way that plays in that economy is significant. At the same time that if you're a teenage parent, your kids are coming to be at risk for street issues at the same moment when their sexual power as women was diminishing. So I think there's some kind of intersection there that's very serious.
The other aspect, of course, is school. I get the sense from reading about Caesar and Jessica in prison that on some level, prison is the only place where they can actually learn anything, you know, book learn anything.
Right. Well, I think it's in part, it speaks to obviously how completely abandoned their, you know, neighborhoods were of any kind of engaging things for kids like them. But I think it also had to do with they were relieved to some extent of the enormous responsibility for their families that they took on. I mean, they could not do anything about the needs and struggle of their families in the outside world while they were incarcerated, and it was a obviously unintended but somehow useful relief for them to be able to be self-focused in a way that I think was crucial for them in terms of just focusing on anything else besides the 10 minor crises that would interrupt a day in their regular lives.
Caesar is the ultimate example of someone who learned beforehand. He didn't want to go. In fact, he signs in for school just so that he cannot go. But later on, once he's incarcerated, he understands the value of learning.
Yeah, he's terrifically intellectually engaged. I mean, we have, you know, I'm constantly sending him books, and we have the most amazing discussions about reading and thinking. I think in part because he was never able to experience solitude until he went to prison. And as a young man, when in a single-parent family for the most part, he was responsible for a lot of caretaking of his mom, policing her behavior, making sure there was food in the house. And because he had so many girlfriends and babies, he had all kinds of ways in which he wasn't able to explore this part of himself.
Is there a possibility that Caesar, Tony is his real name, when he gets out, will be so changed that he will break free of the cycle of poverty?
I believe he will. I think what he faces more than his capacity for that is the hurdle of finding a job as a felon with little job experience. I think the practical hurdles are enormous. I think he has grown apart from some of the important women in his life, and I think there will be an experience of some struggle in that way, but I really think that it's a practical problem of finding decent employment for him. That's really the only thing. I think if he can find a decent job, he'll do just fine.
I think the ultimate thing I come out of this reading is the sense of hopelessness, particularly in terms of a government that doesn't give a damn.
Well, I think the sort of most insidious thing about it is the way that capitalism really works to pressure a lot of these kids for a kind of level of materialism that's just devastating because of their situation. But yeah, I think it's the complete absence of social supports. I mean, I was there for a long time in a community. One felt as though that kind of functioning world of the most minimal attention was light years away, and it's only getting worse in that regard. I certainly feel a lot of hope for these people as individuals, but the, you know, what's going on with public schools? What's going to happen? I mean, the lunch, you know, the breakfast programs are being cut. So now you add that on top of all the other issues.
And the changes in the welfare law?
What I found to be, it certainly was beneficial to Coco in the sense that she loves working and having contact with peers and the exposure to a wider world, and mainly being able to provide for her children has been incredibly empowering. But the downside in her case is that Mercedes, her oldest daughter, and I saw this in other families, that the eldest girl children inherit a terrific amount of parenting responsibility for their siblings because the minimum wage pay requires Coco to work unbelievable hours. So there's a lot of time where there aren't adults in the house. The neighborhood is now only those adults sort of left behind. So the actual sort of makeup of the community is not a good place for young kids who, you know, have no supervision in any constructive way.
So that would be your response to anybody, say, from the right wing who says that welfare continues the system?
What do you think is going to happen in a place where there's nothing for kids to do when they're left alone from 2 until 10? What, I mean, it's not rocket science. And unless you provide real quality daycare, I mean, even decent daycare, I don't even know if I'd aim for quality, but in activities for young people, I mean, it's just, you're guaranteed to see what's happening.
Is it impossible for a young man in that neighborhood to stay out of crime?
Impossible? Oh, definitely not. I think what's more difficult is how does one preserve oneself in the face of a connection to a family that is in a constant state of need. I mean, I saw most young men go into crime because it was unbearable to either see their moms having to compromise themselves in order to get money or keep shame at bay in a way for the ways in which people had to get money. It's not impossible. I just think it's a way of, a person has to really barricade themselves in a way that may be just inhuman and incredibly lonely.
If you've got no choice and that's the only way that you can put food on the table or even, hell, buy a nice pair of shoes or a nice TV, you're going to go for it.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's also, I mean, you cease to see it as crime. I mean, it's just not the way, at least in my experience being there, I never really, it made perfect sense to me just hearing about drug dealing. Do you know what I mean? If you sort of broke it down. But I also, one other thing I found was that I do think a lot of the kids I met were experiencing probably post-traumatic stress disorder, something similar. And I really do think there was something that was happening that kept them close to home emotionally. so that when you would venture out to other options, even if it was a job at, say, a shoe store 10 blocks away, I found kids oftentimes experienced anxiety attacks. And I actually think there were other things going on besides, it wasn't just that it was a little bit more money. I think that the nature of the business somehow replicated something deeply familiar, and that in the absence of other kinds of training and support, it was the way, you know, the river was going to flow in that direction.
There's a remarkable scene where I think it's Coco. Yeah, Coco, I believe, is with Caesar and Jessica with Boy George, and they go
to the Poconos
for the most outrageous weekend.
Vacation, that's right.
And I'm reading that, and I'm thinking, my God, you know, that's a little bit excessive even for those of us in the middle class, but for people in poverty to get a taste of that and then to have to go back must be heartbreaking.
I think, you know, what's interesting is I think I thought that, but I was cured of that when I talked to them at, you know, like I went to the place they'd gone and took pictures, and we had long talk conversations about where they went, and their feeling was that it was just a great thing to have happened. I mean, Coco always thought she was just so glad it happened once. Was I would think, oh, I would never want to know that and then never have it again. And her thing was, it was the best weekend of my life. Till this day, it was a source of such pleasure, even at the memory. So there's a way in which I think they were able to enjoy it when it sort of happened. That I understand what you're saying, but they seem not to feel that way.
Adrienne Nicole LeBlanc, you spent all those years, 12 years, 10 years, working on this book, writing this book afterward. What do you do now? How do you do an encore? Where do you go?
I'm a little bit lost, I think, right now about what to do, and I'm very interested in writing about young men, because I found the urge to scapegoat them one of my greatest challenges during the writing of the book. I think I kept sort of dumping a lot of blame on them, and I want to explore that. So I might follow a young boy in this community from the age of 8 for a year or two. I'm very interested in male identity and women's role in sort of supporting machismo in a way. I'm interested in that. But I'm immediately working a project about comedians. That's sort of what I'm doing. But I am a little bit lost. It's been a transition.
This book deals with Puerto Ricans in New York, or people descended from Puerto Ricans in New York. Do you think the experience in the black community is the same?
I think there are some similarities, but I would suspect that in terms of a lot of the family relationships and some of the employment issues, I would think it would be quite different. I think the male-female relationships are probably my sense is that a lot of the young women that I met, African-American women, they were had a different kind of confidence level earlier on than some of the girls that I met. I'm not sure how much, you know, obviously it's, again, anecdotal. But my hunch would be quite different, actually.
You've been listening to an interview with Adrienne Nicole LeBlanc, whose book is titled Random Family. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.